There's a river flowing in my soul.
In the first part of our conversation, Zaretta Hammond helped us see belonging as the beginning of cognitive apprenticeship, a way of inviting students into the craft of learning. In the second part, she extends that idea into cognitive justice, professional learning, and the challenges of the AI world, where preserving the right kind of cognitive struggle may be more important than ever to cognitive justice. AI is now part of the reality that we will all face and young people will face for the rest of their lives. And it both has affordances, it also creates a set of challenges that are beyond things like algorithmic bias. And one of the things that I think your work can help people think about is what can happen when people can see AI as helping equalize things by enabling people to move more quickly. And so I would just invite your reflections.
Yeah, I think that it's a double-edged sword, right? So I was just talking about over-scaffolding, when used improperly, will just use AI to take out the cognitive friction that's required, both for teachers, right? Lesson planning has learning in it for teachers because they're having to think about, very much like an engineer, how all these things are coming together. So if we outsource that cognitive work to AI to generate our lessons, then we don't necessarily know where we should put that. Now, we can flip that. If we're already doing our thinking and we prompt AI properly, it can be helpful to us as an organizing tool. But it cannot be the generator of the engineer. It's just like an architect. An architect is building the house on paper. Then that general contractor is able to take it and bring it to 3D life. So think about AI as maybe our general contractor, but they're not doing the planning of the house where those beams need to be. All that is, you are the architect. So when teachers understand that role and they learn proper prompting, this is one of the things that's going to be so key if we want to make AI a tool for equalizing access. Teachers need to learn how to prompt it properly. So that's an area of development for teachers. Should students use it? I don't know, because again, or if we're not teaching them how to use it, just getting your essay done is outsourcing the cognitive friction that you need. That's not the part we want to outsource, right? And so I do think it's going to be with us. It is here. And we just need to know how to leverage it. Just like the computer wasn't here and one day it was, and we learned how to incorporate it. Now we have issues with how many screens should students be looking at, right? So every new technology is going to raise its challenges, but it also is going to have its benefits. So we have to be good consumers. And if we're looking through a social justice lens, that cognitive justice lens, then it's going to help us discern when and how we use it.
Talk a little more about cognitive justice.
Yeah, this is an idea that I wish I could say, well, I coined the term. I'm pulling this term because around the World Bank, interestingly enough, right before going into COVID, they set a goal of reducing learning poverty by 2030. And they did a whole report on this idea of learning poverty, right? The idea that adults, people were reaching adulthood, not able to do this kind of deep thinking at a time when we are moving into these places where we have to be able to do our own thinking because AI is coming up, propaganda is coming up. We need to be able to do that kind of discernment. So I found it very interesting that also in South Africa, in the UK, in New Zealand, where they really are thinking about the reparations for the Maori community and culture in terms of that colonization and its devastation on that population, particularly when it comes to education. So all around the world, they've been talking about that. Not so much in the US. The UK is about 12 years ahead in using the science of learning. We're just now trying to have that conversation. So, I wanted to pull this idea that is a global idea together so that people understood this wasn't just social justice, that this was about helping students reclaim their learning power, because that is the key mechanism that systems of oppression use to keep the status quo going versus just. Let's talk about implicit bias, or let's say, like, all of those things are necessary. But I really believe when we help young people become powerful learners, learn to use their brains well and process information. And in the new book, what I do is I lay that out in the six dispositions and skills of a good information processor so that it's accessible. It's not like there's just this big idea. It's like, here are the six things when we are good information processors that we've developed and that we continue to cultivate as we grow through our academic careers. So, yeah, I think that concept is one that I want to hold as an extension of our social justice work in education.
Very important. So, what are those six principles? People will still go through the book, but let them know what they are.
What is really, I think, important about them is that they lead to what I call a set of learn-to-learn skills that students need to develop. And then what I end up doing is breaking each one down. So the first one is students learn to manage their information processing systems, right? And so they learn to understand that they have this in their brain. They name and regulate the emotions of cognition before, during, and after learning. So, again, this is back to that social emotional component. They nurture dispositions that self-monitor and correct cognitive behavior. So they know when they're off track and can get themselves on track. And they do this by developing a flexible set of cognitive structures and routines, so that they have these kind of internal tools and moves that they can go to. And I break those down into five learn to learn skills. But the other portrait dispositions is navigating their social context to assess intellectual safety and regulate their focus, and then using internal and external feedback tools to monitor and adjust their learning moves. So again, it breaks it down. It's a little detailed. It's not like collaboration. That kind of list that lists these kind of 21st century skills. We know those are important, but these are the kind of the craftsmanship of learning, that these are the tools that are going to allow them to turn inert information into usable knowledge, for them to be powerful learners, to reclaim that learning over time.
How do we get teachers who have been educated in the model of essentially the passive model to go beyond the one step you mentioned about talk structures and peer-to-peer exchanges that aren't interchanging, and not just stop with, we got to get the kid to the third grade reading level?
Yeah, I think this is a great question because it really asks us to interrogate what we are doing around professional development. So what passes as PD is really and people think, oh, we're not doing sit and get, but something they can use on Monday, or it's teachers coming in and having activities. But we have to reimagine it as something that once they leave that, no matter how engaging it was, they have to get continued support. And most teachers don't. Research is really clear. No change is going to happen. But the opportunity for them to expand their thinking beyond the implementation of a strategy is really what a professional learning community calls us to do. And so I find it's really difficult for schools to hold to DeFore's principles of a learning community, because he asserts that we should learn by doing. That means you have to have inquiry tools, you have to have process, you have to have teachers actually tracking students. So that's what we actually do. So this year-long process that I've been doing with the school here in DC, I call it the Instructional Equity by Design PLC. That's actually what we try to tackle. It's not a one and done. You're going back into your classroom. You're going to track these focal students. You're going to see how they respond to the kind of teaching you're putting in front of them. You're going to have them as co-designers, right? And those that give you the feedback and the critique that this is working for me or not. And the teachers are going to be basing what they select to tune based on a common problem of practice. I ask them to think about a common problem of practice across their school or across their district or network. And then how does that manifest itself in your classroom? What's your micro pop, right? What's the version that's showing up in your classroom? And then that is what they're trying to shift. And we use the science of learning. As you understand how learning happens, you understand what the role of emotions and social emotional development and belonging, like how are you setting the conditions for that? So being able to engage educators in something that's ongoing, where they're getting coaching, they're having the opportunity to collect data in their classroom. I encourage them to do video or audio if they don't want to use video, and we give them some simple techniques to do that. Because once they start to see that kind of qualitative data, they then can have their aha moment, or they get support because they say, I'm going to try this. I had a math teacher, she's an early career math teacher. She came through a non-traditional route. She shared her presentation yesterday, and honestly, she was the one I was least expecting to see any kind of growth in her instructional practice. And she tried something and said she did four, what we call first pancakes, meaning four iterations and prototypes, iteration on the original thing she thought would make the shift. And eventually she was able to make a shift. Oh, here's where I grew as a result of each iteration. Here's where my students were doing something new in the end. But it's your point. That's a much more engaged process, requires time. So now we have to reimagine time, which can bump up against a pacing guide. Now we got to have that conversation. So now we're talking about the ecosystem of schools and classrooms, not just the conditions, but the ecosystem. So this year, same school will expand so that now we've just created an instructional leaders PLC that will run parallel. So their focal teachers will be the teachers that are in the PLC. So again, we're building the tier so they understand how to create the conditions. This is not just giving teachers a strategy, it's like changing the whole way that they do this work.
How do you do that? The reality is that these teachers are young human beings, very sensitive to criticism for the most part, and aware that they don't have a tenth of the knowledge that they need, and yet we're dumping them into an environment that has these, kids who have different ways of thinking. How do we do this with these kids?
Yeah, I think there is diversity in terms of learners in the classroom, right? We all have an information processing system in our brain. How that processing goes, what connections we make is very different. It's like a fingerprint. We all have fingerprints, but everybody's fingerprint is unique, but it has certain things that are common. It has ridges, it has circles, it has. So when teachers start to understand this about pedagogy and how the science of learning helps us understand how learning happens, then we can actually, with some consistency, start to do that. Now, in our PLC, I don't overwhelm them with information. This isn't the place where they're going to get a lot of additional information. That's not what our sessions are. But we break it down into what I call a 20-60-20 split, right? 20% is new strategic knowledge. What do you need to know about this? So we're all learning about the science of learning. I tried it in my new book. I try to break that down. We use that. They all read that text. But then the 60%, where they have to get the support from instructional coaches that may be in the system who know the same content. Now they're able to have
Mm-hmm.
instructional conversations. So this is back to that ecosystem. So the teacher's not expected to know everything all at once, but here are a few teaching moves that you need to learn, right? So for the students, we break it down into five things. Task analysis is called break it down and size it up. So you're teaching a student when they get a task, break it down. What is it asking you to do? Size it up so you know what the big goal is. And then scan the hard drive. How are you accessing what you already know about this, right? Then the idea is chew and remix. Now you actually have to engage in the productive struggle of trying to make connections between things. Then there's skillful practice, right? How are you now engaging in deliberate practice? Maybe some of that is retrieval practice, maybe some of, but whatever, wherever your own weaknesses are, but that means you have an understanding of how to assess that. This is where the teacher has to be more coach, personal trainer of cognitive development. So that's where we focus on. What does the teacher need to know to be the student's personal trainer of cognitive development? So you're asking a great question, Richard, and I think the reality is it is not the typical ecosystem we've set up for PD. The other 20% after our 60%, our other 20% after the 60% is critical analysis. So we're using Ferrari's praxis cycle, right? Conceptual understanding, informed action, critical analysis. So that's where we step back. Right? How did it go? What needs to be changed? So we are not mixing and matching, right? When we have a meeting that is strategic knowledge, what do we need to get smarter about? We are really focused on that. But then we dedicate a whole meeting to coming together and really understanding what worked and what didn't. So now we are above the instructional core, thinking and reflecting on what went well, what do we need to change? And we're doing this collectively. So we're leveraging Hattie's meta-analysis around collective efficacy, that idea that we're getting smarter together, but we're also getting building our capacity together. So that is what that final 20% of that 20-60-20 split is. This cognitive apprenticeship for adults. And that's what Richard DeFore says. We learn by doing. So that there has to be the doing and the ability to look at what we're doing versus fidelity to strategies. Instead, we turn our gaze toward the student. How do we help the student do it? Here's another connection I'll make to technology. This is user experience in technology. They got a new phone or a new app. They give it to some group of people and they ask them, how is that working for you? Right? What did you like about it? Or they watch people go through the experience. Where do they get stuck? Where do they get confused? And then they go back to the app or the experience and they change it based on this information. That's what teachers don't do because they're covering their content. They're not actually being responsive. And that is the responsive part of culturally responsive teaching. We forget that this is how, what will I say or do to help the student access what they already know or are able to do to move themselves forward. That's how we shift from dependent learning to cognitively independent. But making all those connections back to the ecosystem that's being set up for teachers and leaders and coaches to do this work in depth together.
Great. As we wrap up, if educators listening remember one key idea from this very rich conversation, what would you want them to remember about how they create the conditions where students can learn deeply and thrive and embody collectively their experience of cognitive justice?
Yeah, I think it's a great point. What's the main thing? I say the main thing is for teachers to understand that they need to create a cognitive apprenticeship in their classroom so that where they invite students in to actually take on the task of improving their learning, right? The craftsmanship of learning. That cognitive apprenticeship encompasses everything we've talked about. It creates the intellectual safety, it creates the psychological safety, it creates a sense of belonging. It bridges to now this community of learners where we're going to learn these tools to help us process this content and build our conceptual knowledge, right? It's all connected, but it really starts with creating those conditions so students know that they're coming in not to get a grade, but to become better, to improve 1% every quarter or whatever the marking period is, but that teachers and students are doing that together. Teachers aren't doing it to students, they're doing it with students.
Great. Thank you very much.
You are very welcome.